VentureCast.
Remember, Brian, I grew up listening to the radio and never going to record stores or buying albums.
If you're
going
to play a Sammy Hagar track, though, I have to leave.
I got some bad news for you.
If you're going to play Why Can't This Be Love or something, I'm done. I'm off the podcast. I will not.
We tried to warn him, dude. Tried to warn him.
I will not stay for the playing of that song.
Brian, you actually came because of Tim. You got to let Tim be Tim, man. I'm just giving you.
Who can be Tim? But I will not. And the day of Eddie.
You don't have to witness it, huh?
Cannot be a part of a travesty like that. I will say it's been great to talk to you, gentlemen. I wish you the best, and I'm going to take my leave. I will not be part of a podcast that plays the same thing as long as the best.
Well done.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Tonight,
Tim, we are very pleased to be here, man. I'm ready to do this thing.
This is 1992. Are you guys graduating from college in 1992?
I'm a year out. I'm 1 year into the Branson experience, and I believe I am joined this fall by a young Ben Barton who is looking for something to do with his life and decides.
Did you teach at Branson?
No, he just lived with me in my apartment for a year.
Awesome. Not only did I not teach at Branson.
Oh, dear.
1992 to 1993, I go out to California to live with Jeff, and I get a part-time job. I'm going to go to law school, so I get a part-time job at this nonprofit housing discrimination place. It's a pretty badass job, and it's a great organization. I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
But as you can imagine, that was not super lucrative.
Right.
So I made my actual living driving a school bus, including at Jeff's school.
Isn't that the greatest?
So Jeff's students would get on the bus and they like, "Hey man, Mr. Simons knows the bus driver. What happened to you? Like, did you hit your head? Like, you have a lobotomy? Why is Mr. Simons a teacher and you're the school bus driver?"
Oh gosh, that is rough.
It was a great year. My most common memory of that year is being awakened on the weekend by Ben cursing at Knicks games on an early Saturday morning broadcast, or being woken up with Ben trying to win Madden 92 with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, which was almost impossible.
Trent Dilfer.
Wait. So many things were accomplished that year.
It was great. It was great. We used to go shopping together at Safeway, and we'd be like the nice couple shopping together at 11 p.m. We had a good time.
I've seen that apartment, Jeff Simons. It can't really fit two people.
Oh, there was a whole bedroom I never used. We were cozy. It worked out for us.
All right. Well, good. Well, 1992.
What about you? You were graduating, right?
No, I went to a 5-year college, Northeastern University, the co-op program, 5 years. So I was working at the Boston Globe, which was really, really cool to be doing that as I went through college. So good year, 92.
So two of you guys were actually accomplished that year. I'm 92 is a real loser year for me, for sure.
I played a little Madden myself.
Highlight. Jeff forgot. I would be like, "Hey, man, did you have a hard day? We should go get some onion dip and ice cream."
Yeah.
And then he'd like finish all his grading. I'd be like, "You know what we should celebrate with? Onion dip and ice cream.
It was great.
Hey, I'm kind of bored. How about some onion dip and ice cream?" And that
these two things together? What
they're
are they?
Delicious. Hey, do you live in America?
Together?
Onion dip and ice cream is the way to go.
Salt and sweet. Not in the same bowl, but you have an entree of chips and onion dip. And clear your palate with a quart of ice cream. It's actually a pretty nice way to live. We also, we had some misadventures that year. It was really fun. I have fond memories of 92.
Me too, for sure.
Well, this is going to be a terribly abrupt transition because it sounds like all of us are in pretty good places, although Ben's ascendancy awaits him. but I'm going to bring a real downer because I am going to introduce the Grammy winner for 1992, and I don't even know if I want to talk about it after we hear it.
It's the Grammy winner.
Tears in Heaven by Eric Clapton.
Oh, the tears in heaven.
that what we have? The Jews in heaven have come for us now.
That's it.
I wouldn't know your name. I'm sad to report I wouldn't know who you are.
Stop. Oh my gosh. So, I mean, that was a news story from 1991 that was just kind of took your breath away. Like, wait, what happened? And then to have a song to follow it up. I didn't even know how to process that. Can we move on or do you need to say something?
What you don't remember is the song was written for the motion picture Rush, where Jennifer Jason Leigh plays somebody wants to be an undercover narcotics agent and falls for a drug dealer.
Jason Patrick, a very good drug dealer.
He wrote it for his son.
Sam Elliott is in that movie, glowering over Patrick's shoulder often. That's pretty good. It was this great post-Roadhouse role.
Okay.
I've always found the song really problematic for a bunch of reasons. The first being, it's kind of spooky and creepy to profit so dramatically from a moment of
horror,
of bad parenting. And second, it's one of those songs that the first time you hear it, you're like, oh, that's pretty. And the second time you hear it, it's so formulaic. Like when you learn how to play the song on the guitar, it's like guitar 101. Like it's all these really kind of classic first chords you learn when you're 12 or 13 years old. And so there's something kind of irritating for me that Eric Clapton, who is a virtuoso of the fretboard, and for him to rely on these kinds of like, hey, look, I could play A major to write the song has always bothered me. I have a disconcerting like hate relationship with the song, and it marks the end of my forgiveness of Eric Clapton's
big time. I hate this song, and basically the Clapton journey. Like, he really starts meandering in the 80s. Like, he's really searching for a sound. Yeah. And there's several different records in there where he's, like, you know, trying out synthesizers and drum machines. And you're like, how hard is it, man? Like, listen to a Robert Cray record, play that. That's what we're asking for from you. It's not confusing. But he got really lost in the weeds there. And then it's, like, just a disaster that this was the life raft. Like, there's a different version of it where one of the rock songs hits and he goes back to doing the thing that he's useful at. But this sends him on the wrong path and, like, by a mile. Like, he never recovers. I was like, whoa, that's kind of a cheesy, bad folk song.
Yeah.
We've had enough of bad love.
Yeah, totally.
So... it's interesting. Like, this is a game changer, right? The unforgivable song that Eric Clapton gives us, and like you can't hear Eric Clapton again, right? Because of this song. I wonder if there's a reverse in our future where we take the best songs from artists who we just can't stand and can't forgive for their transgressions.
You mean like one song that you give a pass to?
If we force Ben Barton to pick his favorite Elton John song, like what is he? We should do that sometime because Eric Clapton has some great stuff.
For me, I can't get past
92.
The song for me with the bands I hate is One of These Nights by the Eagles. I love One of These Nights. That song just smokes and it makes
sense. You say?
Oh, I love One of These Nights, yes.
But that was what the two dudes danced to in Hawaii.
I know, that's why it's so great. It brings me right back.
I have The Long Run as my favorite Eagles song. That's not your favorite Eagles song?
No, One of These Nights. It's that bass line by Joe Walsh, that boom, 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 boom. I just love that.
Okay. All right. Well, look, we came out of that with something positive. I was fearful when we started that conversation.
Oh, dude, and also, listen, you softened us up. I don't know if you remember, there were two different songs that were Wind Beneath My Wings. I'm not even going to mention what the second song was. We had the same crappy song in a row. I hate this song. It's a disaster. It ruins Clapton's career, and it's like the fifth best song we've had since 1969, and that's not a joke.
That's not a joke either. Wow.
That's so rough.
That's really awful. All right, well, let's talk about the goings-on in 1992. We have an election. Bill Clinton wins. Ben Barton, can you name the third party candidate?
Was it Ross Perot?
It was Ross Perot. Jeff Simons, can you name his vice presidential
Not Admiral me. Stockdale.
Excellent. Well done.
Where am I? Where am I going?
The Saturday Night Live version of him was so good.
Phil Hartman is the dog that gets left on the side of the road. It was amazing.
Although
that was, I mean, it's funny. Like, I always think of that VP debate as one of the all-time stinkers. But after this last Tuesday, that was was like Shakespeare, those guys.
Yeah, that's right. It really was. All right. Well, this is also the year that the United States has its awful Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia. Mm-hmm. 18 U.S. service members are killed as the United States is trying to coordinate with a U.N. force and feed the Somalian people. But there's a civil war going on and the United States is drawn in. Jeff, do you think the victory goes to Clinton more because of Somalia or more because of Ross Perot?
I think Perot splits the vote and costs Bush the election,
all right,
re-election.
Well, we will be right back on Meet the Press. I mean, that was a hard-hitting political question I had.
Dude, and I should also note, I read that book and I've seen that movie like a half a dozen times. Just all-timers. And also, like, if you want to understand asymmetric warfare, like, it's the best text for that. It's amazing.
It's a great book. But, I can't imagine trying to figure out how to then pull your soldiers out of Mogadishu when it's just a beehive. And the movie gets at that really well.
Oh, yeah, totally.
All right.
The other interesting question is, how much is Ross Perot a harbinger for where we are now, right? Like the use of the hyper, you know, this oversimplified message, the over-reliance on media to communicate the message, the outsider status. I mean,
I think that's not right. I really strongly disagree. Dude, Ross Perot bought a half an hour ad.
Right.
And he talked only about the deficit and he showed graphs.
It was amazing.
Remember this?
Yeah.
He was like, he picked up an actual graph and was like, look at this. It keeps going up. Like, that's completely different than what we have now. He was actually like, whatever else you think about him, like, he had an actual substance to his message. He was not a liar. He wasn't a cheat. He wasn't a huckster. He might have been misguided, but I mean, like, he actually presented an issue to the public and argued about it, in my opinion, in a helpful way.
And it was all about the deficit, right? That was what he went, you know, that the Bush wasn't conservative enough. Now,
just on that one issue, though. Just
right,
on that
Trump
one
would
issue.
Say Bush isn't conservative enough on another issue.
He's like, when's the last time they locked a kid in a cage? He's not doing it.
He picks up a graph. Kids in cages. You can see it here.
And maybe that would work at the next debate. Maybe Biden should hold up some pictures, like the hands-drawn stick figures, you know?
Yeah. All right. Also,
be quieter.
Also in 1992, CDs pass cassettes as far as music sales. More CDs are sold in 1992 than cassettes for the first time. Is this a sad moment for you record store people?
Oh, I hated cassettes always. They sound like shit. They had all that hiss. This whole like hipster thing about, oh, we got to bring cassettes back. I was like, let's bring back, let's bring back outdoor toilets too. You know, like, I mean, like, you really want to be hipster. Like, let's get some lime and a hole in the backyard
and go to work. Don't cassettes sound better than records?
No, they sound way worse. And in fact, records sound better than CDs that sound better than cassettes. Cassettes are just the dog pile.
The death of vinyl was sad, but the death of the cassette, the purchase cassette, like, that had to go.
Yeah.
Wow.
Actually, the death and CDs is the shortest one of all. Like, CDs had like a 20-year window and now they're coasters. It's incredible how quickly that medium. I mean, I don't know how many of you bought DVDs, but they're not worth anything.
Let's do the invitation to cynicism. It is in 1992 where Euro Disney opens. Oh. Now, you might think I'm coming at you with a Disney question, but I'm not. I am instead going to ask you, what opened as well in 1992 that has become the largest tourist attraction in the Midwest, garnering 40 million visitors annually?
Missouri.
It is not Branson, Missouri. What is the largest tourist.
Is it Dollywood?
It's not Dollywood. That's not in the Midwest.
Okay. The Midwest, I don't know. I'm struggling with where that would, like.
It is a structure.
Is it the Mall of America?
It is the Mall of America. That is correct.
I went to the Mall of America in 1992.
Did you?
Yeah, I was there. Like it was been open for like 3 weeks, and like there was
78 acres. 78 acres.
I was flying. I was flying back to San Francisco and had a 6-hour layover at the Minneapolis airport. Uh-huh. And I got off the plane, and there was a sign like "free shuttles to the Mall of America." And I was like, "Well, I got 6 hours," so I took the shuttle, and I walked around. And what I remember in 1992, like only 3/4 of the stores were open. But there's an amusement park in it, like Snoopy Land. But there were 9 candle stores and 2 bookstores. And I just remember, I was like, I'm learning everything I need to know about where we're headed as a country from
that
what's
is
in
the
that
invitation
place.
To cynicism.
Oh,
right
wait,
there.
Dude, I have a grown-up version of this.
Okay, go ahead.
I actually went and gave an hour-long paid talk to the judiciary of the state of Minnesota. And needless to say, it was at the Mall of America.
Oh, God.
In the, like, Hilton that's next to it. So I
you spoke
in the
morning, there.
At the Hilton, there's like a big room where they're there, and I'm on at 10 a.m. And so I get up, and I'm like, you know what I'm going to do? Is I'm going to go in the Mall of America, and I'll get breakfast at the Mall of America. I'll get coffee, and then I'll be ready for my talk because I like to be caffeinated. So I went in. And I like looked at the map to try and find a coffee place. And I found a couple and I started walking and I was like, I'm going to fucking miss my talk. Like, I'm going to be lost in this hideous labyrinth. I literally like took the breadcrumbs back to the door and was terrified to go forward later. I couldn't make heads or tails of the map. It was like a map of the Titanic. Like, rooms everywhere. I was like, what's going on?
So I remember when the bus was pulling up to the mall, like the Mall of America, you could see it from forever away. Uh-huh. Like it's enormous. And then there was this shitty little brown building right next to the mall. It's like, why haven't they, why'd they build that? That was the building where the Minnesota North Stars played hockey. And it looked like a shed.
Like a little
next
box.
I was like, that's a 15,000 seat arena that looks like a cardboard box next to it. That's what gave me the sense of what a big building it is.
Wow. All right. Jeff Simons, let's go to the number one hit.
I believe before I play this, that this broke the record for most consecutive weeks at number one, that this and still holds the record. This is the longest consecutive song at number one in the history of the American pop charts.
Wow. It's the number one hit.
End of the Road by Boys to Men.
We belong together. And you know that I'm right. Why do you play with my heart? Why do you play with my mind? Said we'd be forever. Said it never died. How could you love me and leave me and never say goodbye?
We haven't gotten to the best part. Okay, sorry.
You don't have it yet, Ben?
It's Boys to Men, right?
Yeah.
End of the road.
Yep. I can't let
so that,
go either.
I mean, Boys to Men are good, and they have several good songs. That's not one of them. That song sucks.
Yeah.
The second biggest song for that year, Baby's Got Back by Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Right.
The third biggest song, Jump by Criss Cross.
Yeah.
Both, like,
love
vastly
that.
Superior.
Love
to
that song.
And by the way, Baby Got Back is, like, an all-timer. Can't destruct. Yeah. I mean, even White Boys got a shout. Like, I can't say enough about that song.
All right, Jeff Simons, we are thinking of setting up a new podcast as soon as we run out of years in 50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys. The new podcast will be called The Olympics with Jeff. So in order to get this off the ground, you just have to answer, where were the Summer Olympics in 1992?
Barcelona.
Awesome. And specifically, where were the Winter Olympics?
I don't know if I remember.
You had Barcelona very quickly.
Yeah, because remember Dan and Dave were going to be the whole thing, and then they one of them didn't qualify for the Olympics. So they're
that
like,
"That was that year."
That was Dan and Dave, I think. Oh, shit. I don't think I'm going to get this right. Nagano was 98, and Lillehammer is 94. And so I don't know where they were.
No, this is 92.
I know. I'm trying to count backward.
They started doing the alternate.
They started doing the back and forth. I can't. Give me a hint. Come on. I've been so good.
Okay. It is in France.
Oh, then it's in...
We don't have a second podcast.
Chamonix was 1924. No. And then what's the other French town?
You did not.
I don't have it.
It is Albertville.
Albertville, right.
All right.
Damn it.
I'm going to boo Jeff on that. That was weak.
I know. I couldn't
That was
it
the
all.
Worst performance you've turned in yet. I can't believe you get Albertville.
Well, the 50-year-old white guys go to the Olympics podcast will not be happening.
I think
that's
good for everybody. What was any did anything famous happen at the Winter 92 Olympics? Is that
my research didn't take me that far.
They had some delicious French wine and raclette for sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for the impossible question. Eddie Van Halen died today. Sad news, kind of took us off a second, but we are going to try and figure out which was his greatest riff.
And to do that, we've invited Brian Koppelman, writer, director, and Van Halen nut.
Yeah.
Hey!
They're gone as well. Hey, Brian, how are you?
How are you, fellas?
Nice. I'm an OT Rounders guy, so I'll just leave it at that. I won't say anymore.
Love it. Great.
Well, thanks so much for stopping in. Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Koppelman has hit his head, and he's awoken in our podcast, and he's trying to figure out what the heck he's doing here.
It's like reverse being John Malkovich. He's like, what the hell am I doing in this?
No, I mean, Tim and I have followed each other on Twitter for years. I mean, I think pre-Billions maybe. And
yes,
so yeah. Tim is an old, you know, anyone who was interested in what I had to say on there before Billions, and that I noticed enough to follow back. You're my guy, Tim. So when you asked, I'm happy to do it.
I was with you in the pre-TikTok days. What was it called? The little videos you would do?
Vine.
Yeah, I loved Vine.
2014, yeah.
That was terrific.
Somehow TikTok is not the same. I can't quite. I like watching TikTok, but I haven't figured out how to make them yet.
Right. Well, Brian is here because we are going to have a little Eddie Van Halen love fest right now. We all got the sad news today. I was coaching volleyball and, you know, I've got 12 girls looking at me for directions and I'm like, no, Eddie Van Halen just died. Like I can't go on with the practice.
Since I'm here with you guys, can I ask where everyone's from? Like, where is everyone recording from?
So I'm here in Asheville, North Carolina.
Yes.
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Great.
Awesome. Berkeley, California.
And all right, I got to know, how do all you know each other? Like, what's the thing of this podcast?
If I may say, I am the glue of this organization. So Ben and I are college best friends, and Tim and I are grad school best friends.
Awesome.
And then they become buddies separate from me with their Southern proximity.
Right.
Sure. And then this was Tim's idea. Like,
I see the Bonnaroo poster. Are you all educators?
We are.
Yeah. Yep.
Ben teaches law school at the University of Tennessee. Jeff and I teach high school.
Great. Awesome. What do you teach, Jeff?
I teach English and music.
Great. And Tim, remind me what you teach. Cause I realized I was supposed to come to your class and I haven't, and I will.
Oh, that'd be great. I teach American studies. So,
great.
And
all right.
And we started this, in the COVID times, you know, you were talking about sending out creativity and like positivity and, you know, it's so easy to get down. And this, you know, Franklin Leonard, Brian?
Of course. I love Franklin.
So
yeah.
Franklin came up with this idea of a birthday playlist. I don't even know if he would say it was his idea, but you go back and pick the best song for each year you've been alive, but you can only use a band twice. So then you're kind of locked in and you're trying to figure out what is the best song. And so we cover the Grammy winner, the number one hit, and then we present our case for the best song of the year. my song is always the best, and these two guys try very hard.
Of every year or of just the year?
Yes. So you're on the 1992 podcast right now. So we started in 69, and it's 1992 right now. We do one a week.
And Tim has unquestionably established himself as the music aficionado of
the bunch. The one who makes the final determination. So are you going to make the final determination on which Van Halen riff is the best one? Is
that I think that should fall on my shoulders.
Absolutely.
Gentlemen.
Most qualified to do so.
So yeah. Brian, last question I'm going to ask before we go is, Ben, what do you teach at law school? Because I went to law school. I graduated, but I never practiced. So I'm,
very nice. I teach torts and contracts, and then I do a fancy A2J lab with programming and access to justice.
Contracts is so a good teacher makes contracts the absolute most fascinating course you take, and a teacher who's not that engaged makes it the worst class, I think. Torts is torts.
You can guess which one I think I am. But I love it.
My contract professor, I loved him so much because of the way that he would ask us questions, and it lit up. It really lit me up until I loved it. That's great. All right. Fascinated by everything. And Jeff, what grade are you teaching?
I teach 11th and 12th graders. My focus is African-American literature. So I'm teaching an African-American autobiography class in the fall. And then I teach a class in race relations in 20th century Los Angeles in the spring. And then my music class is half rock history and half performance. So it's a fine arts class where they make a band, but there's also, especially in these times where you can't play together, we do a lot of history as well.
Do you teach Richard Wright in the autobiography class?
I have, it's not in this year because it's truncated, but like it usually goes the Jacobs and Douglas slave narratives into selections from Up from Slavery and Souls of Black Folk, and then Black Boy, and then Malcolm X. Now I close with Song of Solomon because the conceit is that African-American art has this expectation of authenticity that other American art forms don't feel because the origin is autobiography. And so we look at how Morrison tries to pay homage to the past, but also kind of free yourself from it.
I love it, man. That's fascinating. I've read all those books and I know them well.
Well, you should come to my class too then, man.
Have you read the new, Malcolm X book? I haven't read it yet, but people
The Maribel biography?
It's great, but I haven't read it yet.
Phenomenal. It's actually the most, it's amazing you bring that up. I was just talking about it in class today. It's one of those moments of
piped in to hear it, but no, so go ahead.
It's one of those moments of scholarship where you're like, I can't believe what a work. It's like when Gene Fagan Yellen fact checked Incidents of Life of a Slave Girl and found everybody. Like Maribel tracks down pretty much every anecdote and he's able to figure out which ones are probably fabricated.
How much of the Red stuff is true? Like how much of what the life Red lived is as depicted by Haley is true?
Yeah, more than you would think. And actually, it's amazing, you're reading my mind, but there's a famous, remember the famous anecdote where he's got the friend Rudy who sprinkles talcum powder in the old white man? That's only guy they can't find. And Maribel's thesis is that's almost surely X hiding behind a second character because he can't bring himself to admit that he did it. But he has to tell the story because it was so traumatizing. It's great. Right. I really recommend it.
Halen, but I'm super interested in this stuff. I've read the Haley book more than once, twice.
Yeah, it's great.
Great.
Well, that is great. So we just got through
You have the other half of this amulet?
We just got through our political hour. Now it's a book club. I tell you what, this is a podcast for all folks right now. All right, Eddie Van Halen. Brian, you're the guest. Do you want to go first? You could pick one or two like riffs, and Jeff is going to play them for us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to start with Mean Street.
Ha, 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 ha.
I mean,
this is good. This was not on our list, so I'm liking it.
All right, I'm getting ready. I wasn't prepared to.
Tim is musician, right? Grab a guitar and just play the Mean Street riff.
I got it right here. No, I we'll let Eddie take it over.
Riff's coming.
We'll be right back.
That's a good choice right there.
Dang. Good stuff.
To me, that album, fair warning, I remember when that, I'm older than all of you, and they were my favorite band when I was a kid, and my friends and I would wait and stalk the record store because you had to go to the record store, and when we got that record, man, and we were all, went over to my friend Ed's house, and we all just sat down and listened to it together. I mean, you would do that then. It was a communal experience. You know, one, I think for Van Halen, we probably all bought the album, but we went to Ed's house, and I remember just sitting down in his bedroom and a bunch of us listening to it together, and that came on, and it just destroyed us, you know.
Yeah.
We just couldn't believe how powerful it was. And that album cover has this weird image of someone getting punched in the face. And they were a party band, but then suddenly they're singing about this thing that's not at all like a party. And Eddie's riff is just the backbone of it. So that'd be one.
Great.
And then... and then I think my other one, if I'll give you two, is like not even strictly played just on the guitar, and it'd be And the Cradle Will Rock, which he played on that weird, he put the guitar through a bunch of stuff to make it sound like a keyboard, but it's, I think it is a guitar. So I would say And the Cradle Will Rock would be my other big choice.
Here we go.
Love it.
Both album track starters. And I mean, I'm sure you guys are going to do Running with the Devil and all that stuff. But for me, those two tracks are just mind-blowingly cool. And
now, Brian, you said he played it through something. What is the sound? How does he, well, he get that sound?
Jeff teaches music. So, I mean, he can figure. When Eddie would play that in concert, they would bring out for the opening part of it that. Maybe he played it through a Leslie and some other stuff. I'm not sure.
Huh. I'm pretty sure it's a Leslie speaker, which, Tim, is the big speaker that goes next to a Hammond organ that has a rotating fan inside it. So, you know, when an organ does that, like, whoa, 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 that's actually a spinning fan in the speaker. If you put a guitar through it, it has some very cool, very cool after effects.
I mean, I could be wrong. It might not be a Leslie, but I think that's what it is. But that's at the beginning, and then it's his guitar comes in after that initial thing.
That is so cool. All right, Ben, what do you got?
All right, I'm going to tell two brief stories before I go. The first thing is I taught myself to play the guitar in the 80s. And Jeff can say for sure I was sloppy and bad.
Okay.
And so one of the ways you teach yourself to play guitar in the 80s is you buy Guitar World magazine.
Okay.
And several other guitar magazines. And they have a thing called Guitar Tab in it. And what they do is it's got the numbers for the strings and your fingers. And instead, because you can't read music because you're an idiot. You just have to put your fingers on the strings where it says. Okay. So, for example, I learned how to play Sultans of Swing, the entire song, and the entire solo from that. And I mastered it, and I was perfect at it. I learned how to play Sweet Home Alabama from that, and I mastered it, and I was perfect at it. And I kept building my way up the scale. And so when I was like, I love Van Halen. Surely I can master that.
Uh-huh.
And that was a hard no. An extra hard no. Dude, this guy was a virtuoso, like unimaginable. Like, I got good enough where I could hack out Hendrix. I got good enough where I could hack out Clapton. I never came in the neighborhood of Eddie Van Halen. And in particular, the way they would do it is they'd have the strings and the numbers were your fingers, right? So it went to five. Van Halen does a thing called hammering, which is where your other hand is working it. And so they would have those numbers in parentheses. And I was like, what is going on? Like, that's not okay. And dude, so I tried a little bit and I gave up. And then I had the pleasure, and it sounds like Brian did too, you go see him live. And it was like going to see like Tiger Woods live or going to see an amazing tennis player live. He was so fast and outstanding. And he did it all live, like super calm. Like, he wasn't pressing at all. He was so much better than everybody else you'd ever seen, but he was just like another day at the office, just like hammering off. The first time I saw him, and he comes out by himself and he does Eruption. I was like, there's no way he can do Eruption. Like, how are you going to do Eruption by yourself live? Like, surely that was like, you know, studio trickery.
Right, nope. Right.
He just came out and shredded. And also it was like, actually, I wouldn't say off-putting, but it was weird how good he was. Like, he was not like jumping up and down and freaking out. He wasn't at 90% or 95%. He was like, I'm at 60%, you know, 55%. I'm just going to do Eruption and then move on to the next song. No okay. problem. That being said, Jeff, which one are you going to do?
No, you pick. I'll do the other one. I'm perfectly
right.
happy.
My favorite Van Halen song is Little Guitars. And I'm going to ask Jeff to do the classical acoustic part into the full song.
Okay.
Limit there, man.
Yeah, how? Why do I not know that song? That song's great. Why do I know Jump for Pete's sake?
It was on Diver Down. That was on Diver Down, and there were only like five original songs on Diver Down. It was a weird album because it had Pretty Woman on it, and it had Dancing in the Streets on it, which I love, and it had Where Have All the Good Times Gone on it.
Okay.
Strange short album. It was like their least commercially successful. It was a dip before 1984 came out.
Okay.
People. But Little Guitars was the best song on that album by far. And then the other originals on it were like Big Bad Willow, Sweet William. It's like a clarinet song or something.
Yeah.
So it was a strange album, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, totally. But actually, I mean, Jeff will agree. This is our favorite.
Yeah.
I love that record. I love that record just exactly for the weirdness of it. It was like they were like, oh, we got 30 minutes of material. Fuck it. Put it out. And yeah. This, like the classical guitar intro, I've described this guy before as a searcher, and it's perfect. Like, he was just
crazy
guitar nut. Dude, that's him.
Oh, yeah, Tim, he did that on his second album, a song called Spanish Fly, which is the same thing on Van Halen 2, where he played the acoustic guitar and like led to a whole bunch of people doing it. Like, Randy Rhoads did it on this track called D on the first Ozzy album. And that was what Eddie brought that in a way to this sort of modern.
Now, is he growing? Anyone know about his childhood? Is he growing up being classically?
We all know. I'm
yeah.
Sure those
hit me,
know.
Hit me. Is he classically trained?
His father. I mean, any
go
of
go redhead. Go redhead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you asked me on this for a reason. I've read every single book.
Oh, you have. Okay.
That's what I'm talking about.
There's nothing about this. Yeah, I mean, his father was a musician, a classical musician. They grew up playing classical music.
Oh, okay.
In the family, they were all trained musicians. Alex started on guitar, Eddie started on the drums, and they switched. And
fun.
They grew up with a musician as a father. It's how he earned his living. And it's Jan Van Halen. He played on Big Bad he's playing the clarinet.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So yes, Eddie grew up with all
that. Wow.
And he takes that workman-like approach to it, for sure. Like, he's a total professional in everything that he does. It's amazing.
And a total goofball. And that, for me, is the Van Halen magic. Like, I wasn't a heavy metal guy, right? But you have to love Van Halen because there's so much fun. Like the thing that heavy metal and the imitation of Van Halen missed was all the joy and the fun, which is why Diver Down is my favorite, right? All the guys who copied Led Zeppelin copied all the heaviness and the like, you know, bustle in your hedgerow stuff and missed the funkiness. Similarly with Van Halen, they copied all the speed and the metallic edge and left out the fun. And that Diver Down is so fun. The covers are great. Hang 'Em High is a great original on that record. Secrets is an underrated song.
Oh, the like, Full Bug?
The Full Bug is great. And it's great because there are these moments where you're like, this is rock and roll at the absolute top of its game, like right on the edge. Everyone's playing their ass off. And then the next song just takes the wind out of the sails. Like the workmanlike thing is really interesting with Eddie Van Halen. And the thing that's creepy about his like barely trying is the bands that wanted to be them, those guys were like, they took themselves so seriously and they're right on the edge of everything they could do. And Van Halen would come out, you know, a little drunk and a little, you know, like workman likes perfect, right? Like this is a gig, but all it is a gig. Like art is short for Arthur and we're going to play and then we'll get paid and we'll go to the next gig. But yeah, I love little guitar. I just love little guitar.
Lived with that guitar. That's why it was so natural for him.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Everyone says he never didn't have the guitar just with him every place that he ever went. Like, you know, he would just walk around with it on. As soon as he came off stage, he kept it on. So I think it's all just a part of what his life was. He was just in the flow. And so, yeah, he was just in the flow the whole time.
That's, wow. You know, you remind me, that's a perfect description. You remind me, a friend of mine was in Vegas last summer and coming out of a place at 2 a.m. and LeBron James was coming the other direction with two of his buddies. And LeBron had obviously had a couple of drinks and his friends were making sure nobody got too close. And LeBron was air dribbling. He was just like, he was just like working. He was just practicing. And I think of Eddie Van Halen, the guitar, LeBron, like even when LeBron doesn't have a basketball, he's got a basketball. And it's that same kind of like lives and breathes the thing. The sneaky underrated instrumental that he did, which is also on Diver Down, is Cathedral, which is a one take volume knob solo. Let me just play a little quick bit of that. By hammering notes, and he's actually working the volume knob on and off, so you don't hear the hit, you just hear the sound. So he's playing, but you hear the sound a quarter of a second later. So he actually has to be thinking in 16th notes, like play and hear it. So it's like play here, play here, play.
I'm sorry, that was a guitar.
Yeah, it's a guitar, and it's a one take.
Yeah, you don't hear the attack.
Right, you just hear that. You just hear the note. See,
yeah.
But that's not my pick. I'm cheating.
All right,
going back to Fair Warning for my favorite.
Okay.
Little guitars and this one are tied for first. And I couldn't agree with you more, Brian. That Fair Warning changes everything because they go from being a party band to being like Fair Warning and Diver Down are both less than 30 minutes long and they're super weird. And if Diver Down is all of like overdoes the silliness, Van Halen, Fair Warning, like embraces the darkness, right? It has those two really creepy instrumentals at the end. But my favorite Van Halen song intro is Unchained.
And sure.
The lower strings are usually tuned to E. This is down tuned to C. It's too full. Like to play along on the bass, you have to down tune two full tones, and your string is so loose. And I mean, it takes a lot of control to play with a guitar tuned that low. And
and the first time through, riff. Harmonics are where your right hand touches the string halfway and creates this high pitched. It's basically an octave up from it. And so the first time you hear it, it's just dug, 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 dug. If you listen carefully, the second time it goes dug, 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 It's like noise. And that's because he's doing harmonics along with it. The chords themselves are not complicated to do at all, but that bass string you cannot reproduce. Like, it's impossible. And of course, he would do that live. Like, that was no problem for him at all. Just amazing. Yeah.
Tremendous feel. Wow. So that's my Unchained is mine.
That's a great, great pick by you. And so, Brian, you fell in right with them. Nice try. Unfortunately, you all came up short. I have the greatest riff. Remember, Brian, I grew up listening to the radio and never going to record stores or buying albums.
If you're
going
to play a Sammy Hagar track, though, I have to leave.
I got some bad news for you.
If you're going to play Why Can't This Be Love or something, I'm done. I'm off the podcast. I will not.
We tried to warn him, dude. Tried to warn him.
I will not stay for the playing of that song.
Brian, you actually came because of Tim. You got to let Tim be Tim, man. I'm just giving you.
Who can be Tim? But I will not. And the day of Eddie.
You don't have to witness it, huh?
Cannot be a part of a travesty like that. I will say it's been great to talk to you, gentlemen. I wish you the best, and I'm going to take my leave. I will not be part of a podcast that plays the same thing as long as the best.
Well done.
Thanks so much, man.
Awesome. Oh, such a pleasure.
Wow,
that's amazing. I love it. Love that guy.
The next time you say that we're too rough on you, I'm going to remind you that your guest left.
Why do you even hear your selection?
Wow.
Tough get.
I
mean, we should have like really set him up and played like a song by Extreme or something, you know, and then he would have, what's wrong with Sammy Hagar?
So, well, Jeff, you want to say? Here's what I'll say. I actually had a really funny conversation with George about this. We listened through a half dozen or maybe a dozen Van Halen songs.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, does he write the lyrics? And I was like, no, he doesn't write the lyrics. She's like, really? I was like, yeah, no. In fact, not only does he not write the lyrics, there are three different singers, maybe four different singers in the band.
Yeah,
and
right.
She was like, why? And I was like, oh, he doesn't care about that at all. Like, he just doesn't care for that. And so the Sammy Hagar thing, the David Lee Roth thing is cheesy but kind of funny in spots. The Hagar thing just takes the joke too far, and he adds the keyboards to it. He learns all the wrong lessons from 1984, so that entire era is ruined for Van Halen fans.
Who's their third singer after Hagar? Is it the guy from Extreme? It is. Okay,
I believe so. Yeah, that era is. I don't think anybody really. Like, people are just trying to forget that.
But Tim, choose your song. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, here's the thing about Sammy Hagar. Is like, first of all, Sammy Hagar is a really great guy. I have a friend who's played on a Sammy Hagar record, and I have a friend who has flown in Sammy Hagar's private plane with Sammy Hagar. He's a local guy, and he's like in the clubs, in the bars, and when he likes you, he is a good friend to have. So I have nothing.
All right.
But personally, he treats everybody like they're the most important people in the world, but he brings a 70s like he's the I Can't Drive 55 guy, and when you put that with Van Halen, it elevates his thing in a way that's weird, or it takes away from Van Halen in a way that they're just not. It's like bacon and ice cream, those two guys. They're all right separately, but they don't work together at all.
So was there, I'd rather have you guys discuss this and listen to my song. Was there a singer that would have been a better replacement for David Lee Roth? What would have worked better than Sammy Hagar? Because I fully agree. I can't drive 55.
I can't. I don't know.
I love this question. Jeff, see if you agree. I'm going to go with Paul Rodgers of the Firm.
I was just going to say that.
Of the Firm is the obvious answer to this question.
Paul Rodgers, Tim, was the singer in Free that did All Right Now.
Yeah, yeah.
And also is the lead singer of Bad Company and then becomes the lead singer of The Firm.
Really? Friend, same guy.
I got to give credit where credit is due. My friend Kyle Caprista has the perfect line on Paul Rodgers' voice. Uh-huh. Paul Rodgers' voice is so good, it's almost creepy. He sounds like somebody trying to lure you into the trunk of his car, which I think is just
perfect.
The perfect description of that guy's voice.
That is perfect.
We're going to play 10 seconds of your song, Tim. Tim, pick this one.
One, two.
here's the thing. Yeah. You talked about this with Angus Young, the idea that Angus Young is the lead singer of AC/DC, you know, in his guitar. Like, I think that guitar in that particular song trumps whatever Sammy Hagar might take away.
Totally. Yeah, no, great. That was fine. That's good.
That's good. You know what? I have a soft spot for that song because it's the only Van Halen song I learned how to play on guitar.
Oh,
it's
right.
So funny.
There
like,
you go.
You know, the Hagar era is rough because like Ben, I can't play anything from the Roth era, but I actually, that song came on MTV in 88. And I was like, I bet I could play that. And by the end of the afternoon, I could actually play it. I was like, that must not be very good if I can,
that's hilarious.
If I can all squeeze it underneath my fingers. So
let's get to our three songs.
Our three songs.
Who goes first?
I go first this week.
Let's go,
in
Jeff.
In fact, I'm going personal this week, even though this is a great song by a great band, but it's not it Smells Like Teen Spirit. Ben may remember this, but when we were, I think this conversation probably first happened in 1992. We were playing the If We Could Play Like or Sing Like Anybody.
Okay.
Like, who would it be, right? Like, if you could have anybody's voice. And I chose this guy in 1992 as the voice I would most want to have. And I still stand by my choice. He's probably not the best singer, but when this guy sings, it just gets me every time. There's just something about the way David Hidalgo sounds when he sings that I believe anything he'll say. So this is the best song from the best album by a band that I deeply admire and have seen play a dozen times. And they have a wonderful backstory. And I think in 1992, they were at their absolute peak of everything, like as a live band, as a creative studio band. So in 1973, a bunch of teenagers in East Los Angeles get together to play a friend's quinceañera. And they learn a bunch of old Mexican folk songs to make their grandmothers happy. And they're playing them on old traditional Mexican instruments, like the kind of bass that's as big as a stand-up, but you play sideways, mandolins, acoustic guitars. And they're a big hit in the backyard, and people are like, hey, you should do that again. So they make up some business cards and present themselves as like a traditional Mexican folk band for backyard parties. And they call themselves Los Lobos, the Wills. And they actually grow some notoriety with kids their age. They start playing dances, they start playing parties. And unexpectedly, the combination of their kind of traditional folk songs and the 60s rock and roll that they love, right. They're enormous fans, Hendrix, Cream, that first wave of classic rock, that all mixed together becomes a soup. And Hidalgo and his best friend Cesar Rosas start writing songs together. And because Los Angeles is a city where when something is cool, people want in on it, they actually find themselves signed to Slash Records, which is kind of a new wave subsidiary of Sire. And the first thing they do is record all of the folk songs. And they make a little EP. They bring it to the record label. Like, well, we'll release that locally in the local, you know, Mexican record stores. But we were actually looking for a record we could sell to everybody.
Right.
So they make a second record, an EP. They throw a couple of these kind of new Tex-Mexy rockabilly rock and roll songs they've written and a bunch more of these kind of folk songs sped up. But finally, the record company convinces them to put out a record. In 1984, they put out a record called How Will the Wolf Survive?
Right.
And it's a smash with critics. And they're building a following. They're building a kind of curve for themselves. And then the absolute worst possible thing happens creatively and the best possible thing financially. They're chosen to pretend to be Richie Valens for the La Bamba movie,
right,
starring Lou Diamond Phillips. So when Lou Diamond Phillips sings Come On, Let's Go, La Bamba and Donna in that movie, it's Los Lobos. And Los Backing Lobos' version of La Bamba is a number one hit. It sells 7 or 8 million copies. The La Bamba soundtrack is an absolute runaway smash.
It's a gargantuan hit.
Gargantuan hit.
Right.
And it pigeonholes Los Lobos as the Mexican band that sounds like the other Mexican guy. And that's it. America's okay, so Mexicans write La Bamba and they sing it every 30 years.
Yep.
We'll check in later. The next record they put out has a bunch of great songs on it, but it flops. Then they put out another album of traditional Spanish folk, Mexican folk songs. That doesn't sell anything. So this is a band suddenly that goes from this huge hit to being on the edge of being dropped. And they could have gone back and tried to like, hey, remember us? We're the good tiny band.
Yeah.
Instead, they decide to go for broke and become like the most interesting version of themselves that they can become. They hire a guy named Steve Berlin to join the band and act as the in-house producer. They make a great record called The Neighborhood, which is the transitional record to this one in 92. In 1992, Los Lobos hires this production duo, Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake, who are making these really interesting, weird sounding records with all kinds of artists. They make one with Richard Thompson, they make one with Suzanne Vega, they make one, like if you look up Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake, they have a really amazing run in the early 90s. And what they use the studio to do is they're great. It's kind of like if you put a band through like a Midnight Clowns nightmare production, like the sounds become very angular and wooden, and they use all, you know, they take xylophones and put them through compressors. And Los Lobos comes up with a 16 song record that is a folk, it's kind of like Coco before Coco existed. It's this kaleidoscopic, beautiful record with all these colors and ups and downs and story songs. And it's a record about Mexico and a record about Los Angeles and about the distance between the two. And my favorite song by far from that record is this song,
When the Circus Comes to Town by Los Lobos.
Could have had a chance to get out of this rut. The time that you came and the day that you left. Could have had a chance. Could have had a chance. Never thought I could make it this far. With a dent in my soul and a hole in my heart. Never thought I could. Never thought I could. But when the lights are turning round, the wheels are rolling on the ground. The day I'll burn this whole place down, when the circus comes to town.
That's pretty. Good stuff. Really great.
Yeah, my favorite is Dreamin' Blue from that record. But you're right. That record's spectacular. And you described it perfectly. Like they took the leap and it was bold and brazen and it really, really, really hit.
Yeah, it's great. And Dreamin' Blue's great. Peace is great. Wicked Rain, Two Janes. It's just like, it's rare that a 16 song record doesn't have a draggy moment, but it's really, it's so good all the way through, and they pull it off live, and it's the beginning of a series of really interesting, great sounding records in the 90s. Not as good as this one. This is the unquestionably the high point for me, but I love Los Lobos, and I'm so happy they're still around and still playing, and they're just a great story about friendship and time and perseverance and growing as you grow up, and I admire them quite a bit.
Well, I love that they're on our podcast now, because I do think every once in a while of posterity and our kids one day listening to these podcasts, or dare I say, our grandkids listening to this. I'm glad that Los Lobos got a shout out. Like, think of all the bands, like the fact that we don't have Talking Heads, like, oh, that kills me. There's a band I might pick tonight too, because I want this band recognized before they go on. So great stuff. I love Los Lobos.
Well, all right. The Tim seal of approval. I can.
Yeah.
Is that now something? I can leave the podcast.
All right. So when we last left our heroes, the Beastie Boys.
Yes.
Hey. We're finishing up the License to Ill tour. They were on a year and a half tour, and that's their half of their record sales are from that stupid record. The last show that they play is the last time they ever play Fight for Your Right to Party, and they are completely done with that version of the Beastie Boys.
Wow.
They pull off the road, they sober up, and they are very surprised to find out, no one who's not them is surprised to find out, that they're not getting all the royalties that they should, and they're not getting paid by their management.
Uh-oh.
So they get in a full-on pissing match fight with Rubin and Def Jam and Simmons. And this is a running theme through the stupid 80s and 90s. Like, Prince has a breakup with his record company. Just last year, we had stupid George Michael fighting with his record company.
Right.
The Beastie Boys break with Def Jam, sign with Capitol Records, and they're off and running. So their second record, which is actually, in my opinion, the best Beastie Boys record, and it really hurt my feelings not to choose a song from Paul's Boutique. Their second record is, in my opinion, the best sampling record ever. It, like, precursors DJ Shadow, it precursors all of these different people who just do these sound collages. It's a demented sound collage. It's a super extra mega New York record. Like, they're all in New York. They go to New York record stores. They're just doing these samples all the way through it. It is not a hit. It sells a couple hundred thousand records, and Capitol is like, what are we doing with these guys? Mm. They leave New York. They fly to LA. They renovate a warehouse. They put a studio in half of the warehouse. They put a basketball court in the quarter of it, and then they build a half pipe for skateboarding in the other part of it.
Okay.
And they camp out. Capitol Records, this may be apocryphal, but the Beastie Boys tell this story. They're so disinterested in the Beastie Boys now. The Beasties say, we're going to start recording what, like, basically they're talking to the album reps. The album rep tells them, we're much more focused on the Donny Osmond comeback record.
Oh, wow.
Get back to us when you have some tracks.
Oh, wow.
No, they're completely cut loose. They're in the wilderness. There's a version of this where they put out a bad record and they're completely forgotten. They go back to their roots. Remember, they started as a hardcore punk band. They start practicing again with their instruments. They get a keyboardist named Money Mark to join them. And they're just hanging out in LA. Every morning they wake up, they get high. They go to the same diner. They go to the same record stores. They buy a bunch of records and they go back and they have a listening thing where they hang out, listen, play basketball, skateboard, and then start cutting tracks. The first version of the record is all instrumentals. They pitch a version to the label where they're like, weird instrumental punk funk band. What do you think? And the label's like, we're not paying attention to you, but we're not paying that little attention. Like, that's okay. No. We're going to have to come and shoot all of you before you put out that record. That's actually half the record. Half the record is the stupid instrumentals that they cut. And this is a dirty secret for a person who's a gargantuan, massive, huge Beastie Boys fan. The instrumentals aren't that good. They're fine. It's what the instrumentals stand for and what they build for with the hip hop that's what's so completely off. So they take the best of it all. They take the best of the sampling. They take the best of this new instrumental. They learn to play their instruments and they're just in a full sound exploration. And like, there are people who can't stand the Beastie Boys because they're white rappers, and I get that. And there are people who can't stand the Beastie Boys because there's no Kid Rock, there's no Eminem, there's none of this obnoxious, there's no none of this stuff without the Beastie Boys, and you can kind of blame them for that. But that being said, this is the record, and Ill Communication, but this is the record that, in my opinion, that you point to where you're like, this is a unique exploration, and this adds something. This is a completely different thing, and it's actually sort of connected to the Van Halen thing. Often imitated, never come close. People heard this and were like, well, I'll just do this same thing. Never ever like, they captured lightning in a bottle. It's an amazing sound. There's actually three songs that I love equally on this record: Jimmy James, Pass the Mic, and So What You Want. I listened to all three of them on loop today, and I'm going with Pass the Mic. Jeff, please play until we get to the people are talking.
Pass the Mic by the Beastie Boys.
Put that
Super famous line in our family. My beloved wife, Indy Kincannon, is a politician. And so you can imagine she takes a lot of heat. And we will regularly do, though people are talking. that's because they haven't got a thing to say. Break it all the way out. We love that. And then for me, like, the lyrics are so stupid, but super lovable. Like Timmy Walker, I'm dynamite.
Yeah. That's a killer reference. Killer
humor, hilarious. And when I'm in a particularly good mood, I'm really grooving. Sometimes I'm cooler than a cherry pop with ready whip topping. Like, it's just the best, these guys.
I love this record so much. I'm so glad you picked this.
Hey, dude,
I'm so glad you picked
it. The sample, the gong, gong, gong.
Yeah, what is
that one?
No.
I can't place it.
It's Bad Brains. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, of course. Of course.
Yeah. Bad Brains. And then the later one, they've got a.
Yeah.
And that's Hendrix. This record is just packed with.
But the best sample on this record is in Funky Boss, where they have Richard Pryor doing his scared laugh in the beat of the song, where he's like. That one makes me laugh. I've heard that 100 times, and it makes me laugh every single time. It's so great.
I love this record.
This record is the record of 1992. Like, every music fan I knew had Check Your Head and was obsessed with it. Like, Deadheads loved it. Punkers loved it. Everybody. I mean, it's just, it was in the moment. It didn't sound like anything else, but it sounded like a hybrid of all the ingredients we loved from other things. I just couldn't agree more. And I would have picked Jimmy James second for this year. So Ben and I are right on it. So,
well, I love the idea of the 50-year-old white guys podcast getting a clubhouse at some point. That would be so fun. Going to the same diner every morning.
If shit keeps up, I'm up for the weed too. The world's breaking me down, man. I'm trying to be good, but good Lord.
It's been a tough week. Tough week for those in education, let me tell you. Oh, well, that's a great pick. I've got Beastie Boys coming up in 2 years, is it? When's their next album?
I hope it's not more than that. That means you're picking Intergalactic, which I also love. Yeah. Nothing wrong with Intergalactic.
All right. Well, let's go. We gotta wrap this puppy up. I am going to go with Arrested Development, Tennessee.
Tennessee by Arrested Development.
Tennessee.
Lord, I've really been real stressed. Down and out, losing. Although I am black and brown, some problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go to let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone. I never at once felt so alone. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my spare tire. But Lord, I ask you to be my guiding force of truth. Strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee.
Take me to another place. Take me to another land. Make me
So that is Arrested Development and speech rapping. So in gosh, it must have been 2005, he came to my school. We had a civil rights day and we wanted to end it with a celebration. So I reached out to his management and I said, hey, you know, he's in Atlanta. What are the odds of him coming over to our high school? He contacted me himself. He's like, yeah, I'd love to come over. Speech comes over with a dude with an acoustic guitar and the two of them get up on stage and they crushed it for like the last 45 minutes. Jeff, you closed out a Pace Academy diversity day with Rich Price.
And like speech, I answered my own phone in 2005. Right. I was available.
Yeah, you were available. And speech, great guy. And I asked him, you know, in 2005, I guess it was, I was like, hey, whatever happened to you guys? Which is a bad question to ask.
Yeah, man.
When someone is still making music and cutting records. But he was incredibly gracious, great guy. And he's like, yeah, we're still making music. We still have a message. But what happened was the record companies decided to go in another direction. Because this was a huge album. This first album.
Yeah, it's the sound of 1992. That like, you know, you put the drum loop through a filter so it sounds like it's got the scratchy vinyl. Like that was,
yeah.
So many records use that. And I always think of MTV's The Real World when I hear this song. Like that was frequently a background track when the Real World guys were fighting with each other.
Is this Real World New York?
Or San Francisco? Like
Puck.
I moved to San Francisco the fall when they filmed it. And I actually like, I remember I walked by the Stinking Rose in North Beach one night and there's all these cameras filming.
That's what it was.
Three guys my age eating dinner. I was like, wonder what that is. And then like 6 months later, it was on television. But
Oh, wow. Well, anyways, love this song. We would dance to this song. And the fact that I then got to meet him, 15 years later was a real treat. He's still making music, by the way. Speech. And this is also Jeff.
Hey, Speech, if you would like to come on the podcast, I would love to ask you what you're up to again.
To have you. You can't dump me mid-podcast and jump somewhere else.
Ben, you're being very quiet. Are you not going to dump on Arrested Development? You're all right?
That song is good. I like People Every Day better, but I have no beef with that band at all. That record is really good, and all those singles were, you know, they're a little bit cotton candy-ish, but, you know, I'm not going to argue that.
Yeah.
I love this idea of, like, college kids getting together and say, hey, let's make a record. I didn't do that in college.
I did it in college. I just did it really badly.
He had me play on it. It was a problem.
That was a problem.
It was sloppy, but I gave him the tab. He figured it out.
Hey. All right, ladies and gentlemen. What a great night. Brian Koppelman appeared on our podcast.
Unbelievable.
That was great. You set the bar high for our 1993 guest, Tim.
I know, right? All right, guys. I'll see you later. Hang in there.
I might be able to get my dad.
There we go.
All right, let's do it. Let's do it.
Hey, if you're having as much fun as we are, leave us a review on iTunes. Give us a rating on Spotify, iHeartRadio. Wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a shout. And then check us out on Twitter or at our Facebook page, 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys.
Ever thought about starting your own podcast? Do you have a business or a message you want to share with the world?
Well, now it's easier than ever with Electricast. Hi, I'm Mark Netter.
And I'm Peter Rafelson. We're the founders of Electricast Media.
Whether you want to start a new podcast or already have one, join Electricast to grow your audience, monetize your content, and build your community.
With our simple sign-up, you get free promotion, world-class analytics, premium ads, and personal support.
Go to Electricast.com and join our community today.
Electricast. Transform your influence.
Electricast. Hi, I'm Lessa Gaudette, host of Her Extraordinary Life by Design podcast, where we celebrate women who are shaping their lives one extraordinary day at a time. I speak with women from all over the world about what they do and how they are passionately pursuing their dreams and creating meaningful impacts on their communities. So come join us and learn about all there is to learn about these extraordinary women. Electricast.